Well, is there a non-violent way to change the world? I want to start by, you know, going over some of the things that we already know about the world that we live in today. I think we live in a world of immeasurable brutality, a world where daily tens of thousands of people die because they don't have food or basic medical care, a world where hundreds of thousands of people can be killed, millions be driven from their homes in one country for the profiteering and power of the world's already richest ruling class. A world where simple words like rendition, names of places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, are chilling horror stories of dehumanisation and torture. Socialists believe another kind of world is possible. A world without violence, without war, race riots or ethnic cleansing, without rape and abuse, without stolen children or deaths in custody. We think it's possible to have a world where human potential is lived to the fullest, where every single person has more than what they need to live, where people are free to create, to love, to shape their own lives and care for the world that they live in. That is what we work every day to make more possible. Such a world, we say, is worth fighting for. But hang on a minute. Does that really make sense? Why do socialists talk about fighting for a world free of violence? Doesn't violence just breed more violence? And what about revolution? Isn't that the ultimate form of violence there is? Well, no. Revolution is not fundamentally about violence, at least not in the usual way this is understood. And I want to get back to talking about that more later in the talk about what socialists actually do mean by revolution. But first of all, I want to talk about what we mean by violence. Because part of the problem begins with common sense understandings. We live in a world so imbued with systematic horrors that the vast bulk of the violence of the world passes as fairly normal. We are told we live in a world of drug crime, thievery, gang wars and assaults. Yet this depiction of violence by the opinion makers of capitalism is the world seen through a distorted lens. It's a malformed image of what is really going on in the world. When the most powerful military machine in the world invades someone's country, destroys their cities, raids their homes, kills millions, that, I would say, is horrific violence. Yet in the respectable opinion of capitalism, it's the people who resist their homes being invaded, not their occupiers who are labelled insurrectionists and terrorists. After Hurricane Katrina, when New Orleans was laid waste by criminal defunding of infrastructure, when the poorest residents were left to fend for themselves, imprisoned by police within the confines of their ruined city, it was not these same cops who were labelled as violent, not the state and federal authorities that had ripped funding from the maintenance of levees and warning systems. It wasn't the powerful, rich, white families that had systematically driven the mostly black working class neighbourhoods into dangerously low-lying areas in the swamp of New Orleans. When these desperate, trapped residents tried to access the food and medicine that they could see was rotting away in the stores, it was they who were labelled rioters and looters and condemned by the mainstream media. In Australia, when West Australian unionist Joe McDonald last year walked onto a building site insisting on union rights and that safety standards be met in an industry where a worker is killed every single week, he was called thuggish and intimidatory. He was expelled from the Labor Party and taken to court on 5 counts. Yet when James Hardie bosses bury scientific evidence of the dangers of asbestosis for nearly 6 decades, which all told will kill 18,000 people and leave tens of thousands seriously ill, nothing is done to these murderers. Far from languishing in prison, they languish in their mansions on multi-million dollar payouts. With so much violence in the world, I think it's understandable that people's instinct is often to ask, how can we get away from the violence? Is there a non-violent way to change the world? But I think the first thing we have to come to grips with is that we have to be careful when we ask this not to accept the logic of capitalism, that what gets labelled violence is by and large the actions of ordinary people, and very often it amounts to cases of blaming the victim, like the ones that I've outlined, for causing the violence of the system, while the real horrors of capitalism are passed over. And actually, it doesn't end there for socialists. We don't seek simply to even up the balance sheet by exposing the violence of our oppressors. We question the whole basis by which oppressor and oppressed are measured against the same yardstick. The Jewish people who rose up in the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II did so in heroic resistance against fascism and genocide. They armed themselves, they built explosives, they executed collaborators. But surely only the most cold and abstract court of morality would dare compare their use of violence to the Nazis who calculatedly sent millions to horrific deaths. The Aboriginal people of Palm Island who burnt down the police station after yet another man was killed in custody because they'd finally had a gutful of the deaths and of the cruelty, racism and impunity with which the police had always acted against their community. How can they be compared to the cops who brutally beat to death Mulrinji Doomadgee so bad that his liver split in two? The young Lebanese people in Cronulla in 2005 who revolted in horror at the previous day's racist riots cannot be measured by the same scale as the disgusting racists who terrorised Arabs and Muslims, beating people up, tearing off their headscarves, wearing T-shirts saying things like ethnic cleansing squad. People who are backed into a corner often have no alternative but to resist by whatever means they can. And in any and all of these circumstances, socialists always always side with the oppressed and exploited, no matter what the tactics are that they felt it necessary to use. Because it seems to me that the only alternative would be to condone the role that the systematic violence of the oppressors plays in crushing people down and forcing them to fight back. Well, I'll get back to more of that later, but, you know, that's all very well. But what does this say to the vast majority of us who don't actually directly face the violence of reactionary forces every day of our lives? After all, in Australia, for the most part, no one literally points a gun to our heads to make us get up and go to work in the mornings. Actually, they don't have to. For most of us, that work was done long ago to our ancestors, who were brutally separated from their land by sword, fire and murder, who were driven throughout the world with hunger and imprisonment. Capitalism was founded on expropriation, colonialism and slavery. In the past 5 centuries or so, against the bitterest resistance in every corner of the globe, a new, extremely powerful ruling class rose to power on the backs of theft, plunder, and murder. When a minority rules over the majority and concentrates land, wealth, and power in their hands, that minority can only maintain its rule by backing up its power and privilege with force. That's where the violence of capitalism fundamentally comes from. From their need to maintain control because their profit is based on the exploitation of human labour. Capitalism has created a class of landless labourers, the working class, that is the majority in every country around the world today. And the dispossession of our ancestors means that we now have no other means of life besides working for a boss. That's the economic force that gets us out of bed every morning, that compels us every day to go to work, no matter how much we might wish to be doing almost anything else. Only if we do this can we make ends meet. And even then, most of us live only a couple of paychecks or a mountain of debt away from being on the street. If disaster strikes, we can't choose to stop paying our rent or just start taking food off the supermarket shelves. If we do this, the police, the security guards, the enforcers of capitalism are there to hold us in line when the normal methods of economic compulsion fall through. So the system we live under rests on violence. Even when that violence is not being wielded. It was founded on it, and it remains to this day fundamentally geared against the ability of ordinary people to stand up for ourselves. Of course, we are all equal under the law. As they say, the millionaire and the homeless person have an equal right to starve under a bridge and are subject to the very same vagrancy laws when they both beg on the street. So the very laws are built to defend the existing order, to protect private property and to legitimate the exploitation of the vast majority of people. Wherever capitalism goes, it uses force and violence to uphold minority rule. And the main way they do this is through their control of the state, by which we mean the government, the bureaucracy, the education system, the legal system, law enforcement, the army. Now, I think most people in societies like ours think of the state as the authority that stands over the struggle between capitalists and workers, kind of like a neutral body mediating the conflicts of society. And there was a talk this morning about that some people might have been at. But just to go over some of these things, in practice, the most senior judges, the politicians, the police officers and generals, they're all linked together. And they're all linked to the captains of business and industry through their networks, their wealth and their power. And not only that, but the law which claims to be above all is not based on human dignity, but actually on what protects private property. So there are two sides to the violence of capitalist minority rule. The law, which protects business and private property, and the legal violence, which can be used in defence of this law by police, the army and the other institutions that have a monopoly on the right to use armed physical force in this society. So whatever the mythology about it, law and order are the means by which the capitalist system defends itself. And this means that whilesoever workers or oppressed people confine their struggles to legal means, they will lose. Whenever we build mass movements to break down an unjust law or practice, we swiftly find ourselves engaged in illegal behaviour. And once the line has been crossed into breaking the law, the state has full authority to use whatever force or violence is deemed necessary to restore business as usual. People here probably remember the hysteria surrounding the APEC conference last year. When protesters converged to vent their disgust at the dealings and the warmongering of the world's super rich, Central Sydney, I understand, was turned into a militarised zone. With the media and police mounting frenzied claims about the threats to public safety, the authorities fell back on justifications like the war on terror to justify spending millions on checkpoints, water cannons and riot police. When was the last time in Australia that people had to show ID simply to walk down their own city streets? And of course, this had nothing to do with fears of terrorism and everything to do with trying to terrorise ordinary people into staying away, trying to criminalise people's right to protest and fight back. And in all of this, the media, owned and controlled by some of the wealthiest capitalists in the world, time and again present these struggles and their repression in a supposedly even-handed way, legitimising the force of the powerful and condemning the resistance of the workers and oppressed. So while many people can probably agree with statements like a bad law is made to be broken, and while thousands actually do engage in illegal strikes and protests all the time, because of people's experiences of life and this weight of official opinion, most people still continue to believe there should be a neutral body standing above social conflict. After all, drink driving, interpersonal violence, theft, murders, pub brawls, surely all of these things require some sort of state force to deal with. Yet we also need to understand this kind of violence, which seems to be nothing to do with the ruling class, in a framework of a fundamentally violent social system. There's a violence that doesn't rest on guns and police. Grinding poverty such that you cannot put shoes on your children's feet or go to the dentist. Having your home ripped away from you that you have worked so hard for because you can no longer pay your mortgage because of the instability of the capitalist economic system and because of the lies of bankers. Unemployment, grueling hours of work such that you never get to see your family. Having no support to care for your disabled partner. This is the immeasurable scale of violence that passes for normality in our society. So it's no wonder in this world that the abuse, you know, that the abuse that is so violent to everyone's lives all the time then plays out between people who live in such situations of frustration and despair. But this socialist analysis of violence also carries within it the seeds of hope. Because alternative explanations for where violence comes from tend to start and end by saying there's something fundamentally wrong with human nature. And being the beasts we are, there's nothing we can do to change that. Only the protective net of the police and the state is stopping us tearing each other apart. Right? Obviously, humans are capable of violence, but we're also capable of love and self-sacrifice, of compassion, of music and creativity, of huge complex community organisation, of amazing visionary feats of labour and imagination. It's no coincidence that the system which subordinates all these amazing human qualities to profit can only talk about the one human feature, violence, which is the hallmark of their system of death and destruction. And it's why a specifically socialist perspective on the world is so important as we come back to talking about the title of this talk, How We Can Change the World. Because it means that we can understand capitalism not just as a powerful system of violence and oppression, but as a resisted system which can be defeated so that a world based on human dignity and human need can be built on its ashes. But only if the majority can unite against the ruling class. This is what we mean by revolution, mass democracy forcing fundamental change to the setup of society. That is clearly not a violent occurrence. Why on earth would you need to use violence when you have numbers on your side? And the key force is the vast groups of people capitalism itself has created, the working class. Our labour creates the wealth of the world. Our work practices require cooperation and organisation to get the job done. And the political and social crises which are inevitable under capitalism are the sparks that can unite this massive potential into a movement that can bring down capitalism itself. This is a potential that history has expressed again and again in every mass working class struggle and revolution for 200 years. This is what socialists understand by a socialist revolution. Was anyone here at any of the Work Choices rallies early on, you know, a few years back? Now imagine those rallies going on week after week. Imagine them gaining momentum and growing bigger along the way. Imagine the government starting to worry about how to stop them happening, trying to fine workers for striking, arresting activists, trying to organise the follow-up actions. But the attempts at intimidation don't work. They just draw more people into the activity. The next step is a general strike. The whole country is now focused around this test of strength between the movement and the government. The government refuses to budge and uses violent police repression against the weakest parts of the movement. An indefinite general strike is called until the government resigns. In workplaces and communities around the country, ordinary people start to make the decisions about what the priorities will be for their lives, for their schools, their communities, their environment. There is not just one scenario for revolution. There are many outcomes possible from this vision of the buds of mass democracy. Some of those outcomes include murderous repression in the event of defeat. But this flowering of mass democracy is what socialist alternative means when we talk about workers' revolution being the only possibility for ending the bloodshed and violence of capitalism. Now, what has that got to do with the popular vision of revolution as a bloodthirsty armed coup? Not much. Absolutely nothing. So why then has revolution got this reputation of it has of being violent, undemocratic, and bloody? I think there's a few reasons. One is the consequences of defeat. Having spent close on 500 years building states and empires and privileges beyond our imaginations, of course the minority at the top is not simply going to hand back their power over the world. Everywhere their right to rule has been challenged, they have fought hard and dirty to maintain it. In some places, for example, in Iran, Chile and Spain, where workers' revolutions failed to win, an orgy of bloodshed followed. Two is the Cubas and Chinas of the world. One-party dictatorships are not workers' democracies. These systems were brought to power by the political struggles and warfare of a minority, not by mass working class struggle. In other words, they represented a changing of guard at the top while maintaining the system of capitalist exploitation, and they used the cover of communism to justify it. Three is simply the myth-making of capitalism. For example, about the Russian Revolution. It suits the pro-capitalist historians to paint Lenin and the Bolsheviks as a cold, isolated, monolithic force, where in fact they were a massive working-class party, the expression of a workers' revolution in its fulfilment, the living embodiment of the aspirations of Russian workers for a better life. This bias against revolution and socialism, this constant message of "don't try this at home, kids," is intended as a warning to people not to stand up for our rights. It's not a true depiction of working class revolution at all. It's a warning to say if you fight back, you will, you know, be defeated, there'll be blood, it'll be trouble. So socialists aren't bloodthirsty or any more violent than the next person, but we are determined to end capitalism. And we are absolutely clear that defeating capitalism itself can be carried through neither through prayer nor military coup. Neither the bullet nor the ballot, but only mass workers' democracy will end the bloodshed of capitalism for good. Capitalism is the most violent social system ever to have existed on this planet. There is no degradation of human life to which it will not stoop in the relentless pursuit of profit and market share. Grotesque birth deformities from chemical weapons, agonising deaths from radiation or chemical poisoning or asbestosis, food dumped in the ocean, war for oil, global warming that threatens to destroy our whole planet. Stopping this violence for good means taking a determined stand and fighting. It means a mass movement breaking its illusions in the neutrality of the capitalist state. And that means confronting its violence, using the strength of numbers, the strength of workers' power over production to win out. Even when the action is illegal and when the violence of the state is called out against it. I wouldn't call such confrontations with the state violence, but it is certainly using force, the force of unity, solidarity, the strength of human struggle against inhumane exploitation. In St. Petersburg, Russia, in 1917, after months of revolution and counter-revolutionary struggle, only 6 people died in the ousting of the old existing order on the night of the insurrection. How? Because the working class was strong. Because they had the army on their side. Because after months of struggle, Petersburg workers and soldiers were finally united in their realisation that revolution was the only way forward for them. Stripped of its standing army, of its monopoly on the use of armed force, of its prestige and authority, there was finally very little the ruling minority could do to resist. It is this kind of power that socialists look to in revolution. not the violent uprising of a small layer of insurrectionists, but the united power of the working class taking over the reins of society. Millions upon millions of downtrodden people repossessing and collectivising the private property of the rich, toppling the capitalist state and claiming their own right to rule in a mass workers' democracy. In this sense, revolution is an act of force, the force of the majority of exploited, downtrodden people against the tiny minority who have ruled over them since time immemorial. And there's a smaller example that illustrates what some of these dynamics mean for us today. I mentioned earlier the massive police crackdown threatened against APEC protesters. But the defiance of tens of thousands of people in coming out to protest anyway showed that they would not be cowed by the threats. It made such a crackdown by police much more difficult. And though I couldn't be there because I was living in the States at the time, I'm told that at one point, Socialist Alternative's modest contingent was approached by police trying to take away our red flags, the traditional symbol of workers' struggle that we always carry. They told us we weren't allowed to have sticks over a metre long, and our flagpoles were over a metre long. We were reluctant to give up our banners of liberation. But it looked like there might not be a lot we could do. But while we were negotiating whether we could cut our flagpoles down to undersize, up marched the many hundred strong contingent from the Maritime Union, one of the most combative unions in the country with banner poles many times longer than ours. The cops quickly backed away and left us alone. The police and the military may have a legal monopoly on force, but they too are capable of calculating the balance of forces to hand, of seeing when they're outnumbered, how much they think they can get away with and what will only make things worse for them. So it's not just in revolution that a strong show of working class confidence and unity can force the state to back away. Such a process is always a measure of where each side is at. Whether it's in fighting for reforms or in full-blown revolution, it's the kind of show of strength, this confidence and unity that socialists look to push back the forces of reaction. But if this is so, why then don't socialists go around proclaiming we are non-violent? Wouldn't that make us more popular with everyone who hates the violence of the system and doesn't understand that revolution is about mass democracy? This is an important question of politics. Because as I said earlier, socialists are not against the use of violence in any circumstances. Revolution is a form of collective strength that does not glorify violence, but nor does it shy away from its necessary use. The fundamental question to be answered is not violence or non-violence as an abstract morality, but how to defeat capitalism. There is no possibility of a non-violent world in which capitalism has not been done away with. To totally renounce the use of violence, or what can be called violence, can only lead to defeat for the struggles against capitalism. Sometimes it is necessary for workers' struggles to resist violently to arm themselves, because the ruling class will stop at nothing to defend their rule. And when they turn their guns on you, when they open the door to 18 foreign armies to crush you, as they did in Russia, arming the revolution is the only responsible choice that can be made if you are to avoid slaughter on a massive scale like in Chile or Iran or Spain. When revolutions are defeated like this, it's not unusual for the respectable, law-abiding, civilised bourgeoisie to slaughter tens of thousands of people. Rivers of blood and mass graves are the only thanks they will give us for shirking the necessary use of force. When a revolution is under siege, when the world's most brutal system resists the claim of millions to mass democracy, when they continue to try to crush our human freedom and take all the wealth of society for themselves, as they inevitably will, there is no real choice but to defend the revolution with everything it takes, as millions of revolutionary Russians chose to do. There is a certain luxury in being able to debate the question of whether we should be violent or not here in Australia. It's not necessary for us to prepare for death every time we publish anti-government literature or go to a protest. But what can a philosophy of non-violence say to the people of Iraq, whose armed resistance is the central reason why the US-led occupation is falling apart today? What can it say to the Aborigines who have never stopped resisting invasion and who still stand up to racist police? As I said at the start, socialists do not see all violence as the same. Russian revolutionary Trotsky stated it succinctly. A slave owner who through cunning and violence shackles a slave in chains, and a slave who through cunning or violence breaks the chains. Let not the contemptible eunuchs tell us that they are equals before a court of morality. Political philosophies of nonviolence frequently fall back onto this mistake, into condemning the very resistance to the systematic abuse and oppression that they purportedly oppose. And unfortunately, this is no less true of the most famous proponent of nonviolence resistance probably in history, Gandhi, certainly in recent history. Again and again, he came down against the mass struggle of Indians against British rule. In Peshawar in the early 30s, after the arrest of local leaders, a crowd resisting colonial occupation burned an armoured car, its occupants escaping unhurt. Troops opened fire on the crowds, killing and wounding hundreds. Two platoons of Garhwali Hindu troops refused to fire on a Muslim crowd. They broke ranks and fraternised with them. The police and military withdrew. Yet Gandhi, far from impressed with this triumph of non-violent mass action, condemned the troops for refusing to fire on the crowds, siding with the corrupt morality of the murderous authorities. He said, "A soldier who disobeys an order to fire breaks the oath which he has taken and renders himself guilty of criminal disobedience." I cannot ask officials and soldiers to disobey. If I taught them to disobey, I should be afraid that they might do the same when I am in power. The result of this kind of philosophy of non-violence is simply ruling class morality. Have whatever protest you like, but don't cross the line of fighting to win. The only chance you have to stay non-violent is to respect the capitalist law, which makes illegal the kinds of actions which can defeat it. That, not violence or non-violence as an abstract principle, is the problem we face in changing the world. Socialist politics is essential here. Socialist politics analyses class society as a constant process of class struggle. That means that every time we push to make some gains, they push back against us. We have to be clear, capitalism cannot be made less violent. It must be destroyed by mass human action. Without this concrete understanding of the world we live in, the question posed by the talk cannot be answered in a way which leads to a sensible discussion. Where political philosophies of non-violence mean trying to diffuse conflict rather than build for victory, I cannot say, yes, there is a non-violent way to change the world. But I strongly reject the caricature of revolution and socialist activism as violent, which is a caricature created by the capitalist class, arising in large part from their repression of resistance and revolution, from their bloodthirstiness and brutal means. So is it possible to defeat capitalism without confronting the system's violence? Unfortunately, no, it is not. But the stronger our side is, the more united, the clearer we are on the power that working class people wield, on the need for mass revolution, and the greater the level of socialist organisation, the less chance the ruling class will have to make us pay for standing up to them. Capitalism is daily dripping with blood, through and through, blood which only grows deeper as the system becomes more powerful and more disastrous. The only way we can bring it down is through mass revolution of the working class, expressing the confidence, unity and determination to see the revolutionary struggle through to victory. Only this way and no other will we see a world in which human beings are guaranteed to live free from the obscene violence of capitalism that daily does untold damage to billions of lives. Only then will we see an end to the violence of this world for good.